something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fans in the UK, Robert Lamb here with a really important message. If you're a listener in the UK, you will stop receiving new episodes in this feed after July 31st, 2023. But don't worry, you can still listen to the show. All you have to do is switch over to the brand new Stuff to Blow Your Mind UK podcast feed and subscribe there. So no cause for alarm. It's just a click away. The feed is called Stuff to Blow Your Mind UK, and it's already live, so you can subscribe right away. And as a little incentive for making the switch, we're including a UK-exclusive Monster Fact episode for you, and this episode will be ad-free. So please don't wait. You might forget. Head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and search for Stuff to Blow Your Mind UK and subscribe today. And be sure to remind any friends who listen in the UK to do the same so you don't miss a single episode. Thanks for listening. Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, so we are reaching into the vault to pull out an older episode of the show for you. This one originally published July 28th, 2022, and Rob, this was your interview with Antonio Padilla, author of the book Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them.
Yeah, this is a fun chat. I think ultimately a very accessible chat, but one that will also probably break your brain a little bit. So have a good time with this one.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb. My co-host Joe is away from work today, so I am conducting an interview here with Professor Antonio Padilla, author of the new book, Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, a fascinating read about big numbers, fantastic numbers, black holes, and more. This is a really fun chat. I think you're all going to enjoy it. So go ahead and jump right in with me right now. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. Really excited to talk about the new book, Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them. A wonderful read, and it's a book that gets into some pretty wonderful, mind-rending, cosmological territory, as we'll no doubt discuss here. But first, I wanted to start with just a really basic sort of grounding question, I guess. We encounter numbers every day, and you discuss some numbers that most of us don't encounter really every day. If we could back up a whole lot, I guess, and just ponder the basics here. What exactly is a number?
Well, I mean, this is an idea I sort of delve into in my book, because of course when you go really back into history, back to sort of the ancient Sumerians or something like that, obviously they really began to use numbers to talk about, well, I've got five jars of oil, I've got five loaves of bread. But then it sort of begs the question, is that five the same five? Is the five that describes the jars of oil the same five that describes the loaves of bread? And then you really sort of when you sort of make that, you disconnect the two and you start to build the idea of like what I call an emancipated number, a number that's independent of the thing that it's describing, then you're really sort of making quite an intellectual leap. So that for me is what a number is. It's kind of emancipated from the thing that it's describing. Whether such a thing really exists in a philosophical sense is a whole new debate that you can have. But yeah, that for me is the key mathematical leap that I think was made, you know, a long time ago. And yeah, it's really important.
Now, getting back into that sort of philosophical territory, this is one that I know that you tackle a lot. It's a pretty standard sort of philosophical math question. But is mathematics more of a human discovery or more of a human invention?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a straightforward answer to this. Of course, this sort of, you know, boils down to like I sort of alluded to, whether numbers exist, whether maths exists. And it's kind of, I mean, I'm not a philosopher, but I know that philosophers talk about this in sort of this kind of three different angles that you can take on it. So on the one hand, you've got the Platonists who will say that numbers and mathematics is true and it exists, but it exists outside of space-time as like an abstract concept. It's not something that can affect the things in space-time. It can't affect the material objects that we have around us. You also have the nominalists who said basically that numbers and maths only exist to sort of understand stuff. So in some sense, we talked about the five jars of oil, the five loaves of bread. That's the only reason that the number five exists, to describe the jars of oil, to describe the loaves of bread. And then, of course, you've got the third sort of, you know, school, which is perhaps in some sense the most extreme, which just says the numbers don't exist at all. They're just a useful tool that we use to describe the universe around us. And I guess the analogy people use here is it's like saying, well, you could be an atheist, but you could still believe with some of the sort of moral messages that you read in the Bible or the Quran. It doesn't mean that, you know, you can't be inspired by them, but you just don't have to believe in every element of it. I guess as a physicist, for me, it's kind of hard to sort of go with that fictionist idea and yet see a universe that is so amazingly described by mathematics. Now, is that something that's embedded in the universe or not? I guess it's really difficult to know. We've certainly not seen any evidence that it isn't yet.
Now, your book deals with, as the title indicates, fantastic numbers. What defines for you a fantastic number, and are there categorizations of numbers other than that we need to have in our heads before we can get to the idea of what is truly fantastic?
Yeah, so for me, my own relationship with numbers kind of, it comes from, on the one hand, you have a number, whatever that number might be. And then for me, I always want to bring that sort of personality alive, the sort of real spirit of the number sort of to the fore. And so it's always been physics for me that does that. So when, you know, you can have these wonderful mathematical concepts, ideas like Graham's number, tree three, these truly bizarre and wonderful numbers that have a wonderful place in mathematics. But then you really bring them to life when you try to sort of squeeze them into our physical world. So that for me is what makes a number fantastic. It's almost like what makes a number fantastic is the fantastic physics that it can lead you towards and lead you to imagine, and whatever that might be.
You also talk about, I believe you're talking about Graham's number pretty early on in the book, and you point out that if you try and actually picture it in your head collapses into a black hole. And this made me wonder, like, what are the largest numbers, roughly speaking, that an average person can fit into their head by one definition or another? Like, at what point does it just become this other enterprise entirely?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So I mean, it kind of depends on how you sort of define the question in some sense. If you're just thinking about neurons, how many neurons have you got in your brain? There's about 100 billion neurons. And so you might say that you can use them, if you manage to clear your mind of every other thought, to imagine a 100 billion digit number. Okay, that might not be particularly practical. It might be quite challenging for most of us, but in principle, you might say that would be the limit. Of course, if you then go beyond that and start to say, well, what if I could somehow get my head to find a way to actually store information, store concepts more efficiently than just the usual idea of neurons firing on and off? Let's suppose that it could do that somehow. Then the numbers get much bigger, and you start to the things that limit it are literally preventing your head collapsing to form a black hole, because black holes, what they do is that they're the best thing at storing information. So if you want to get something the size of a head, of a human head, and you want to say, what's the best thing the size of a human head that can store information? It's a black hole the size of a human head. That's the, nothing can do it better. And so that places a new limit. And you can ask, well, again, what is that limit would be? Well, it's certainly way below Graham's number. You're not going to get anywhere near the magnificence of Graham's number. You could probably get a digit that's about 10 to the 70, a number that's about 10 to the 70 digits long. So less than a Google digits long. Having said that, you could imagine a number like a Googleplex. A Googleplex has a Google digits. Now, I've just said that you can't imagine a Google digits, not possible. But a Googleplex you could, because what you know about a Googleplex is that it's a one followed by a Google zero. So you know that all the numbers that come later on are zeros. And so there's not much information in that. So it doesn't cost as many bits. You don't have to put as many bits in your head to imagine that. So what we're really talking about now are really a random assortment of digits, a completely random assortment of digits, the kind that would appear in Graham's number. And I don't think you can get past around 10 to the 70, which is a one with 70 zeros. You couldn't get past that many digits completely randomly sort of allocated. At that point, your head's going to collapse into a black hole.
Now, backing up to the Google and the Googleplex, can you walk us briefly through the difference between a Googleplex and maybe realms beyond that? This is about the only area of fantastic numbers that I'd really heard anything about prior to reading your book.
Yeah, so a Google is a number which is a one followed by 100 zeros. So I think everybody would agree that sounds like quite a big number. It goes back to a physicist called Edward Kasner, who was at Columbia, and he was writing a popular science book, and he was trying to sort of, you know, convey, he really wanted to show how big infinity was. And so he wanted to come up with numbers that we all think are really big, like a one followed by 100 zeros. And he said, well, okay, that's really small compared to infinity, right? Even though something really big is actually really small compared to infinity. So he came up with this one with 100 zeros. He wanted a name for this number. So at the time, he asked his nephew, who was 9 years old at the time, who was called Milton Sirota. He said, can you come up with a name for this? And Milton said, well, a Google, which is an absolute stroke of genius, right? It's such a great name. So they wanted to then develop things further. So then they wanted an even bigger number, again, building on this idea that it's nothing compared to infinity. And so he said, well, okay, I'm going to come up with the idea of a Googleplex. It's going to be an even bigger number. Well, how big? So Kasner then goes to Milton. He says, well, how big should it be? And Milton's like, well, it should be a one, not followed by 100 zeros, but zeros until you get tired. But Kasner's like, you know, a sort of esteemed academic at Columbia and all that. That's just not precise enough for him. So he went with it, which are much more sort of well-defined idea, which is a Googleplex should be a one followed by a Google zeros. So a Google's already massive. That's a one followed by 100 zeros. A Googleplex is a one followed by a Google zero. So it's a whole new level of big compared to what we're normally used to.
And then it keeps building on that, right? There's even like what a Googleplexian? Is that the next level?
So yeah, I mean, this is a really nice idea. You can really now start to really build very big numbers very, very quickly using this mathematical technique called recursion. So for example, you can develop the idea of a Google duplex. Well, what's a Google duplex? Well, it's a one followed by a Googleplex zeros. Mm. And then you could go to a Google triplex. Well, you can probably guess what it's going to be. It's going to be a one followed by a Google duplex zeros. And then a Google quadruplex is a one followed by a Google triplex zeros. And you can see each time you're growing the number just by so much, by such an unimaginably large amounts. And that's what, you're not just adding a zero every time, you're kind of really ballooning the number of zeros on the end of this number in gargantuan proportions. And that's what, and it's this power of mathematical recursion that allows you to do that.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O Allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Now, you also talk about fantastic numbers that are, I guess you would say, smaller. The main example that comes to mind, and you refer to this several times in the book, is a number associated with Olympic sprinter Usain Bolt. Would you tell us a little bit about this number?
Yeah. So, actually, this is one of my big numbers, actually.
Oh, yes.
Even though it doesn't seem that big. it's one of my big numbers. So I can read out the number, what it is.
Okay.
15 zeros, 858. So it's just a number just slightly north of one. So it doesn't seem like a big number, but in my book, I say it is a big number. The reason is it measures the amount by which Usain Bolt managed to slow down time when he was running in the World Championships in I think Berlin, and he set the world record. And this is due to the effects of relativity, so that when somebody actually moves quickly, they actually slows down for them. And this is the amount by which Usain Bolt was actually able to slow down time due to the effects of Einstein's theory. And it's compared to the people in the stadium, for example. This was the difference that he experienced. So one of the weird consequences of it is that you can actually... It's not that Usain Bolt actually, even though he slowed down time, it's not that he actually ran the race any quicker. He still runs the race at roughly 10 meters per second. It's actually an even more strange consequence. The track also shrinks for him a little bit. So he actually runs it in less time, but in the same speed. Therefore, the track shrinks because relative to him, the track's moving. And this is another effect of relativity, one of the remarkable things. And yes, you could perhaps argue that he didn't actually finish the race because the track shrank, so he didn't run quite 100 meters.
Wow. I was really blown away with this because you often hear the standard analogies concerning airplanes and pyramids and so forth when it comes to like time dilation and so forth. But I hadn't heard this particular example before. This is great.
Yeah, I mean, it's true of like taxi drivers. If you imagine a taxi driver that's driving around, I don't know, any city, New York, wherever, you know, sort of for 40, 50 years of their life, because of that extra speed that they're picking up, that's going to accumulate over time. And actually, they can probably leap forward in time by probably, I think, about a microsecond over the course of their career. It's not a lot, but it's still pretty amazing when you think about it.
So they've got the knowledge and then they have that as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. Not just the knowledge. Yeah, they actually get a little bit younger.
So your book makes use of written numbers, and of course you have this wonderful YouTube series, Number File, and in that you benefit not only from some fantastic descriptions and pop culture tie-ins, as you do in the book, but you also have a lot of helpful illustrations. So I was curious, since you are a regular communicator of this topic, is it more challenging, or in some cases almost too challenging, to describe some of these numbers without the visual aids or the actual numerals to like visually present somebody with?
Yeah, I think you. So this is where the physics comes in some respects, mm-hmm. right? So on the one hand, if you really want to describe the number, like I say, a number like Graham's number, you do need those visual aids because it's not a number that you're going to sort of stumble across in any kind of normal environment, right? It's not a number you're going to see on a price tag, at least you'd hope not. And, you need new notation, new sort of symbolism to sort of actually even describe the number. So you've got to introduce that. There's just no getting away from it. But I guess what you can do is describe the physics associated with it. And that you can certainly do just with words. And, you know, in the case of a number like Graham's number, you can talk about how you just can't picture it in your head because your head will collapse to form a black hole. And that's already going to make people think, wow, that number, there's something big and crazy about that number. Or a Googleplex, you know, and you can talk about a universe that's a Googleplex meters across. And then you can ask, well, if the universe is that big, if the universe is literally that large, then it's likely that you would find multiple copies of yourself, like literally exact doppelgangers elsewhere in this ginormous universe.
Yeah, I wasn't prepared for doppelgangers to enter into the scenario. So that was another great part about the book for me. And another thing that comes up in the book that I was very intrigued by, I was wondering if you might talk about, is the idea of the holographic truth.
Yeah, so the holographic truth is, I mean, it's an idea. It's probably the most important idea, I would say, that's emerged from theoretical physics in the last 30 years. And it's actually mind-blowing when you really think about what it pertains to. It's this following statement that essentially one of the dimensions of space that we experience around us, so we normally talk about, say, three dimensions of space. Well, one of them could well be an illusion. It might not exist. And it's really remarkable. So what we're saying is that there are two ways in which you can describe the physics that we see around us. On the one hand, we can imagine a three-dimensional world with a gravitational force and the force of gravity doing its thing with planets around the sun and so on and so forth. On the other hand, there's a completely equivalent description of the same phenomena, which just uses two dimensions and no gravity. So think of it a bit like, you know, on the one hand, somebody's, you know, in English, we say, if we see a plate of meatballs, we call them meatballs. But a Spaniard might call them albóndigas. They're both describing the same things. They're just using a different language. And that's kind of what the holographic truth says. It says that you can have a theory, like a three-dimensional world with gravity, and you can use that to describe all the physical phenomena you see. Or you use this different language, which has no gravity and only requires two dimensions of space. So is it true of our world? We don't know. It's a conjecture. It's a conjecture that has sort of evidence coming from the physics of black holes. There are actually concrete examples that we know of sort of toy universes. So not our universe, but space times that maybe they're higher dimensional, they may be warped in weird and wonderful ways. And you can think about gravity in these simple toy universes. And you can show that there's an equivalent description in one dimension less, like a holographic description. And it's called a hologram because that's essentially what holograms do, right? If you think of a hologram, what have you got? You've got an image that's stored on a holographic plate. You know, it's just some light and dark bands on a holographic plate, a two-dimensional plate. It stores a bunch of information that way. But that's just one way of looking at the information. You can decode it in a different way by shining monochromatic light through it and creating a 3D image. You're not creating any new information. It's the same information, just stored either in two dimensions or three. And it seems to be that seems to be a fundamental property of gravitational worlds, that you can think of them as like I said, a 3D world with gravity, or you just forget about gravity and consider a world with one dimension less, and you can describe exactly the same physical phenomena.
Wow. Now, here's another question that came up reading the book that I don't know if all of our listeners necessarily would have thought of this question, but I think some of them would have, and that comes to infinity. Infinity, like sometimes it's easy to think of like, okay, infinity is if we think of it as a number, we think of it, it's the eight on its side representing infinity. Is infinity a number? And if it's not a number, like what do we think of it as? How do we classify infinity?
So I love this question because the answer is that it's both not a number and lots of numbers. this is the wonderful thing about infinity. So it depends how you want to think about infinity. I think most of us, when we intuitively think about infinity, we kind of think of like, I don't know, the infinite distance, you know, or infinite time. And what we're really thinking there is we're thinking of it as like a limit, as something that's just beyond our finite realm, that's, you know, if you keep on counting forever, you know, it's kind of at the end of that, or sort of almost beyond the end of that. Now, that's in some sense thinking of infinity as not a number, as a limit of say, you know, the whole numbers. But what Cantor, George Cantor, the great German mathematician from sort of the late Victorian times, what he did was actually taught us how to count beyond infinity. So literally using really smart ideas associated with something called set theory, he was able to show that actually you can have all the sort of finite numbers, and beyond that you can have infinity. But that's just one layer of infinity. You can have the infinity, which is all the whole numbers, but you can also have a different layer of infinity, which is all the numbers between 0 and 1. So think of the continuum of the numbers between 0 and 1. That's, you think there's an infinite number of numbers between 0 and 1, but that's actually a different infinity to all the whole numbers. So you've got, you know, these discrete infinities, continuum infinities, and they have different sizes, and they have, you have many layers of what can be an infinite number. And this is what Cantor really began to explore and develop. And he met a lot of resistance when he was doing it. People thought he was crazy. He sort of fell into a lot of depression. You know, he was in battles with someone called Kronecker, who was kind of, you know, the big guy in Berlin at the time, the elite university in Germany. He thought that Cantor was just delving into sort of witchcraft, and he called him a charlatan, a corrupter of youth, and this really bothered Cantor. And actually, it's quite a sad story. I mean, Cantor actually sort of really fell into quite bad depression. Whether it was because of this or whether he was predisposed anyway, it's not clear. But he actually ended his days sort of very sort of emaciated in a sanatorium, essentially starving because of the effects of the First World War at the time and not having enough food. So it's quite a tragic tale in the end, but he was certainly a tremendous mathematician. And now all his ideas are really, you know, I think people acknowledge him for the genius that he was.
Yeah, it of course brings to mind those like the infinity hotel discrete scenarios that are used to describe infinity. I've always found those to be super interesting and mind blowing.
Yeah, I mean that's what I mean. So as I said, Cantor sort of had these different layers. So you can sort of imagine the first infinity, which he called Aleph Zero, which is he defined as the set of all the whole numbers, essentially all the natural numbers. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to, well, infinity, all of them basically. So that's what he called the sort of first infinity. But then you can have these higher infinities, which are the, you know, things like the set of the continuum, essentially the continuum between zero and one. So not just all the fractions and rational numbers, but also the irrational numbers, numbers like one over the square root of two, that kind of thing. And this is a new layer. He actually proved that that's a bigger infinity. And it's not immediately obvious, but he did show it, and it's remarkable. And there's so many sort of things about infinity. There's so many paradoxes associated with them. For example, one thing you can say is you think about the number of are there more square numbers or whole numbers? And you think, well, you think naively, obviously there are more whole numbers than square numbers, because one is a square, but two isn't a square, and three isn't a square. Okay, four is. So it seems that there's obviously more whole numbers than square numbers, but actually it's not true. And the reason you know that's not true is because you just take a square number and you can map it to its square root and you get the whole numbers. So the number of whole numbers is actually exactly the same as the number of square numbers. It's completely crazy. Oh, wow. And it's the same. There are the same number of even numbers as there are even and odd numbers. And there's the same number of numbers between zero and one as there are between zero and two. There's all these paradoxes that emerge the minute you start to think about infinity. And that's why most mathematicians for a long time just stayed away from it. But Cantor was brave enough to climb into this infinite heaven and explore it.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Now, one of the numbers that comes up a lot in your book, and I know you've done videos on this as well, I'm almost afraid to ask about it because it just seems kind of I get confused anytime I read anything about it, and that's this idea of I'm not even sure if I'm saying it correctly. Is it? Do we say tree three?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, tree three.
So yeah, what is this?
What is Tree 3? So there's a particular game that was developed involving some trees, right? So the details aren't too important. It's just that basically you draw these little stick trees and you have some seeds, you have some lines, which are kind of like the branches, and you build these trees, right? So one of the rules of the game is that, you know, for example, you can't have a tree that's got a bit of a tree that's appeared before. So if I draw, like, you know, one particular tree, then later on you can't draw a bigger tree that's got my tree stuck in it somehow. It's just not allowed. That would end the game. So there's a bunch of rules in how you draw these trees and build up this particular game, which I call the Game of Trees. Now, how long the game lasts depends on how many different types of seeds you have. So you could have, for example, just black seeds, okay? Or maybe you could have black seeds and you also have got white seeds. Or maybe you've got black seeds, white seeds, and yellow seeds. You know, there's a whole bunch of possibilities. How many seeds you play with sort of changes how long the game can last for. Now, if you've just got one seed, the game can only last one move. You can just write down one seed, and that's it. You can't write down anything else because anything else that follows is going to contain the tree that went before. Okay? Mm-hmm. If you've got two seeds, like a black and a white seed, the game can last you can draw up to three trees, and the game will automatically end after just three moves. It can't go beyond three moves. So you've got this sort of sequence. So if you've got one seed, you can play only one move. If you've got two seeds, you can play three moves. And so then you go to three seeds. And you might think, well, I started off with one, then it went to three, and now I've got three seeds. Maybe I can play 10 moves or something, or 15 moves. It shouldn't be anything crazy. Well, it is. So this sequence just goes bang. It just goes from one. So just for one seed, you get one move. Two seeds, you get three moves. And then three seeds, you get three moves is where the game will last to. And this is a number which just blows everything else. So we talked about Google and a Googleplex. Well, that's just nothing compared to Tree 3. Talk about Graham's number, which will collapse your head to form a black hole. That's nothing compared to Tree 3. Tree 3 is just, it's impossible. I mean, I actually think it is impossible to imagine how ridiculously big this number is. And it's just so mundane where it comes from. Is this game? So you start off, you play this game with two seeds. Oh, this game keeps ending after three moves. And then somebody comes along and adds a different colour seed. And you're like, okay, how long can the game last now? And somebody says, Tree 3. And this is Tree 3, which is a number that's actually too big for the universe. It just, whoa, where did that leap come from? Leap should not be that big. But that's in an essence what Tree 3 is. And it is too big for the universe. So one of the things I worked out was, suppose you're playing this game involving these trees. So you're drawing these trees, right? So you play one go, draw a tree. Play next go, draw a tree, and so on. You've got three different colours of seeds. So we know the limit of the game is Tree 3 moves, tree three different trees in the forest. How long are you going to play? Could you finish the game? And one of the things I imagine is, you know, you're playing this game at high speed. So you're playing it as fast as space-time will allow. So you literally, if you play it any faster, space-time will break due to quantum effect. So you play it super, super fast. And so you play it again, you'll play it through a lifetime. You'll get nowhere near Tree 3. After you die and maybe you replace yourself with some artificial intelligence, you've got two AI machines playing against each other, you know, powered by the light of the sun. They'll keep playing the game at this crazy pace and they keep going. The sun gets bigger, you know, it goes to a red giant. All these things happen. Eventually it falls back, forms a white dwarf over many billions of years. And still these two AIs are still playing the game because they have got nowhere near Tree 3 and they're playing at breakneck speed as well. And so eventually they lose power. They can't get any power because the sun dies, right? So they need to somehow develop some new technology which gets energy from, I don't know, the cosmic microwave background radiation. And the game goes on and the game goes on and the game goes on. In fact, the game will go on way beyond the sort of heat death of the universe. And still you will not get to the end of Tree 3. And actually, there's a phenomenon called Poincaré recurrence, which says that in any system, in any finite system, you'll eventually get back to where you started. And that applies to our universe too. So you can imagine a pack of cards. You know, if you shuffle a pack of cards enough times, you'll eventually get back to the point where all the cards are in order. It'll take a long time, but it will happen eventually. It's the same with our universe. You shuffle the universe enough times, you allow it to evolve for long enough, eventually it'll get back to where it started. It will reset. And that reset time for our universe is actually shorter than the time it would take to play this game of trees all the way up to tree three moves, playing as fast as you possibly can. And so even if you could do it, even if you could live past all these, you know, gargantuan timescales, the universe is just going to go, nah, mate, game over. We're resetting. You ain't going to get to the game. You ain't going to end this game. So tree three is actually a number that's actually too big for the universe. That's how big it is.
It's just so astounding that, as you describe it, it's such a short step to reach that point. Because a lot of these numbers, like when you're talking about the Googles and the Googleplexes, it's easy to think, well, those big numbers live out there. Like, they're like in the deep water. But then this seems to illustrate that, no, the deep water is far closer than you think.
And it's not, I wouldn't even call it deep water. It's water that's, you know, you're sort of like, yeah, you're just sort of tiptoeing across the, you know, through the shallows, and then, and then bang, it just gives away underneath you. And there's just, it's bottomless as far as you're concerned. Wow. You know, I wouldn't even call it deep water. It's beyond deep. It's too deep for the universe.
Wow. So ultimately, what do fantastic numbers reveal about the cosmos? Like, what is the, well, I guess, what is the lesson of big numbers, fantastic numbers, et cetera?
So for me, I think all the ideas that I talk about in the context of the big numbers in the book, they all come back to the same thing, which we talked about, which is the holographic truth. The idea that a lot of the ideas associated with black holes and how much information you can fit inside a black hole, where that information's stored, for example. Is it stored inside the black hole, or is it stored on the edges of the black hole? And these are ideas which lead you to the holographic truth, to the idea that actually, maybe the information in our world isn't stored inside the world. Maybe it's stored on the boundary of the world, at the edge, on the walls that surround it. And in that sense, that's why it's holographic. All the ideas, all the limits that we're talking about, you know, counting how much information you can store in a head, you know, and when it's going to turn into a black hole, you know, counting how long it takes for our universe to reset itself. All these ideas come back to the question of how our universe stores its information. Does it store it inside? And if so, how does it store it? Well, actually, no, it turns out it seems like it stores it on the edge of space. And that allows you to count how much information there is in that space and how many different ways you can combine things. But it all comes back to that holographic truth.
I have to ask about this because I'm not as versed in mathematics as a lot of people out there. And one of the things that I kept thinking about reading the book was just a one quick joke from a season one episode of the British comedy Look Around You, in which the narrator, the episode is about math, and the narrator tells us that the largest known number is around 45 million, but that larger numbers might exist, and they like speculate 45 million and one could be a number. And, you know, of course, that's absurd, and it's absurdist humor, but there's something about that seems to sort of ring true with a lot of these concepts. And I was wondering what you thought about the role of absurdity in contemplating big numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I really do think it. So when you think of something like tree three, at least within our universe, you can't fit it in. It cannot fit in. There's nothing that could, you know, you could describe, because it's just too big for anything that we can talk about in our universe. Now, you might imagine other universes which could accommodate it. And in a, you know, a sort of multiverse scenario, like maybe you get from something like string theory, could you get universes that can contain tree three? Well, maybe. We don't know, right? We don't know enough about the multiverse of string theory, but it's not inconceivable potentially. So, but certainly in our world, you can't. It's interesting. One of the things, I did a video quite recently actually about the biggest number that nobody will ever think of. And I did these sort of quite, a bunch of estimates based on, you know, a bunch of dubious sort of, assumptions, which I acknowledge were quite dubious. But I think I came up with an estimate that if you think of a random 73-digit number or so, something of that order, then probably nobody's going to ever think of it other than you. I mean, you know, so I'm not saying like just think of a 1 followed by 72 zeros, clearly not something like that, but just complete random. Random 72, 73-digit number, something like that. Chances are nobody in the history of humanity, either before or to come, will ever think of that number. And it's kind of, that's kind of mind-blowing. I think it's kind of yours. Just think of it, and that's yours forever. Mm-hmm. So just everybody should just write down a 73-digit number and name it after themselves.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, Tony, thanks for taking time out of your day to chat with us. I want to make sure we're hitting all the plugs here. The book, which is out, I believe it's out now, correct?
Yeah, it's actually released today in the US. Like, probably shouldn't say today, should I?
Cause it's probably not gonna come out. I guess it will have been released 2 days ago when we published this. So yeah, it's out. It's Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them. And then the YouTube series is Numberphile, correct?
Yeah, so I appear on Numberphile. There's another channel I appear on, which is more physics-based, called 60 Symbols. So they're both made by Brady Haran. And so I appear regularly on both of those. So it's a lot of fun. But yeah, it's. I hope people enjoy the book. It's and just don't think too recklessly about Graham's number, because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, we don't want anybody's heads to collapse into black holes.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show. Hope you have a great day.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. Well, thanks once again to Tony for taking time out of his day to chat with me here. The book, again, is Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them. Highly recommend it for anyone who is at all intrigued by what we were talking about here today. As always, if you want to reach out to us and ask any questions, share your relationship with Fantastic Numbers, well, you can find us in a number of ways. Let's see. If you email us, and I'll give you that email in a second, you can have access to the Discord where you can discuss show matters with other Stuff to Blow Your Mind listeners. There's also the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module that is on Facebook. You can find that and seek access to that as well. And of course, thanks as always to Seth Nichols Johnson for producing the show here. And yeah, if you want to get in touch with us, you can simply email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.